All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. One of the originals of the medium. Always still audio. Just talking to you in your head, you know, on your little speaker, in your car. You don't have to watch anything. Just talking. We're just talking here. There's an organic thing to it. Do you know what I mean? There's a just this, just me and you, or perhaps me, you, and whoever's sitting there tolerating me, or perhaps it's me, you, and one of your kids or two of your kids, where you have to explain what something means or why you think that guy is funny. I know there's a lot of different scenarios, but ultimately, it's a fairly candid, intimate conversation. And on that note, today on the show, I talked to Greg Fitzsimmons. Greg Fitzsimmons has been on the show a few times back in the day. He was on a very early episode of WTF with some shorter segments. Then he did a full one, I think it was back in 2011, episode 139. But Greg and I go back. We go way back. He's got a special coming out this week. It's called Greg Fitzsimmons, You Know Me. But we go way back, man. I mean, back to the beginning. I think he might have started a little after me in Boston. But over the years, we have a thing. We have a dynamic. And it is friendly, but sometimes it feels like it's right on the edge. I texted Brendan, my producer. He said it was great. We have a good dynamic. And I'm like, yeah, it's taut. It's a little taut, but there are those kind of sort of friendship dynamics that are got a little edge to them, and you kind of, you know, you're waiting to get stuck a little bit, but it's pretty funny. God damn it, I love funny people. I went to a party the other night. I hadn't been to a party in a while with a lot of comics, and I was like, you know, people I've known for years, and I was just, holy shit, I'm able to laugh a little more. Maybe I'll talk about that. Look, Greg is on the show today. It was funny. It's a humorous intensity, I think, that we get, engage in. I keep in the loop as much as I can. I did spend about 12 minutes in my car. I had driven somewhere to run an errand. I was going to look at some new frames for my head. To kind of try to get me into some place where I can understand the character I have to play in a movie next month or in October. And I sat in my car and because I had started a reel on Instagram, and it was literally, I think Chinese, because the caption was in Chinese. And it looked like a car had been taken out of the mud. It looked like a car that had been in a flood. So it was covered with mud, and there was no way to get into the car. It wasn't a great car. It was just an okay car. I couldn't even tell if it was new or not, but it wasn't like some classic automobile. And I watched somebody wash it off, take it all apart, clean off the rust, foam clean it, and put it back together. And at the end, it was just an okay car. But it was salvaged. But the point is, I couldn't get out of my car because I was watching someone clean a car for like 10, 12 minutes. It's very satisfying. There's a lot of weird, satisfying things, but there's nothing more clearly a dopamine hit than the sort of satisfaction. I mean, back in the day, I mean, I used to enjoy watching my clothes in the dryer. I felt like I was doing something. I wasn't doing anything. I had shown up with the clothes at the laundromat, and I guess that was a big deal. But there was something satisfying about watching my clothes in the dryer. So maybe it's that impulse or that kind of connection that is really what watching your phone is all about. It's no different than finding satisfaction in watching your clothes tumble dry. Is there a way we can get back to that, folks? Can we get back to that America where you could just sit and watch your clothes dry and maybe think a bit on your own. Maybe read a book. Maybe look at the vending machine. Maybe get a box of the little box of detergent. Sure, maybe look at the other people. Maybe wonder, you know, what? Why was that piece of clothing left there? Is that anybody's? Does anyone work here? Does anybody work here? Man, just watch. I've watched drains work. I've watched unclogging drains on Instagram. I watch large pieces of dough made into things. It's the same thing. We've got to get back to the dryer, people. I'm telling you, man, we had at least had some control over our brains then. You know, you could, there was a meditative quality to it because you were in the world. Your clothes were drying. You know, maybe you sat out front of the laundromat, smoked a cigarette. That was the days. Huh? Wow. Look, I'll be in Tucson, Arizona at the Rialto Theater on Friday, September 20th. Then I'm in Phoenix at the Orpheum Theater on Saturday, September 21st. I just had to reschedule my dates in Illinois, Napa, and Sacramento. Sorry. You know, this is it. Yeah, I have an opportunity to do this flick, this movie, this piece of cinema for October and a bit of November here in L.A., and I'm going to do it. And if you're still with me on the other side of that, great. I'm just figuring stuff out, man. I'm 60 and it's not bucket list stuff. It's just opportunities that have come from me doing the work I have done. And I'm going to take those opportunities and then see if I enjoy them. And if I don't, I'll figure something else out. It sounds like I might start going to laundromats and just watching dryers. That's not bad. Huh? Go to WTFpod.com/tour to get dates for the shows that were rescheduled in 2025 and to get tickets for all upcoming shows. I am moving towards a HBO special taping. I have to get that hour back up there. Yeah, you know, being up in Vancouver, being out of town, and then coming back in, I don't know, man. I think I'm kind of a cranky loner, but I'm not. I love hanging out with people. You know, I don't know if I can go on vacation with people, but I like hanging out with people. Like I did a couple of weeks ago, I did Bobby Lee's Tiger Belly, and I love that guy. We had so many laughs, got some good laughs with Greg Fitzsimmons today. I went to two parties last night. That's big. Brendan Small from Metalocalypse, who I've known forever. Yeah, we'll get together. I don't think I've seen him since before the pandemic. It's crazy. Where does the time go? And I don't think the pandemic is the only reason that fucked up my time. Like, I know I keep hammering it, but I'm 60. And I don't know where 50 to 60 went. That was like a black hole. But now I'm seeing people for the first time in years that I felt like I used to see at least once a year. But yeah, I got to catch up with Brendan. That was nice. He showed me some of his weird new guitars. I saw Pat Healy, great actor. Him and I go way back. I'm not nostalgic. I'm not looking back. But it's always good to see people and just have that moment like, yes, yes, still alive, fucker. Then I went over to Dana Gould's birthday party. Now, that was a collection of geniuses. Geniuses. I don't know what you know about comedy or who you think is great at comedy. But in that room, over there at the Tam O'Shanter, on that patio, some truly funny fucking people, Dana being one of them. Dana Gould has always been a brilliant, genius fucking comic. That's really the issue with me, is that I know what funny is, and I know, you know, there's a difference between me going like, oh, fuck, that's really good, and me genuinely laughing. The combination of them sometimes has to, you know, I have to get over my resentment of their being funnier than me or whatever I think is funnier than me, because I can never think of what they thought of or make myself laugh as much as they just made me laugh. But that's all sort of going away, you know, that resentment trip. It's just going away mostly. But at Dana's party, it was like Dana was there, Patton was there, Blaine Kapach, another wizard. Matt Weinhold, San Francisco genius, who I haven't seen in a long time. Laura Keitlinger was there. Maria Bamford. That's like, That's some powerful, hilarious people. Lorraine Newman was there. It was, and I'm not dropping names. I'm just like sort of happy to be part of that community and just talk to people. Any of those people I could walk up to and within, you know, 16 seconds, like get like huge laugh. Oh, fuck. You got to laugh, man. Oh, my God. Dana was funny. They brought his cake out and it was a picture of him on the cake from high school. And, you know, he's just one of those guys. I'm just waiting for him to be funny, you know, and he's, gets up in front of everybody, and he's like, I'm not good at this. And he said, there's never a good time to say this, but I'm dying. Oh, God. He's a dark motherfucker. So funny. All right, look. Greg Fitzsimmons, again, very funny guy. I've known him a long time. It was fun to have him on. His new stand-up special, Greg Fitzsimmons, You Know Me, premieres tomorrow, August 27th, on his YouTube page. This is me and Greg talking again. I was trying to figure out, you know, what we talked about the last time you did this, but I think the last time you did this was like the first year of the podcast.
Probably. No.
I think so. Episode, well, all right. So 139. And that was 2011.
13 years ago.
Let's see what the description says. Comedian, author, and podcaster Greg Fitzsimmons is back on the show. Oh, his first time on Mark's home turf. Where the fuck were we? The last time they chatted, it got a little heated. this time they're looking to bury the hatchet. But they'll take a few swings at each other with it first. And, yeah, so I guess that's probably what we're going to do today.
All right.
I'm not sure I even know what the weird issue is that we have, but it's all right.
Well, I think that the tension is that we started at the same time in the same place. And I
was it exactly the same time?
No, you started a little bit ahead of me.
Yeah, before you. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And you were around.
We went to the same college. We were both English majors at Boston University.
But when did you graduate?
89.
Yeah, I graduated in, 86, and I graduated a year late. So I was supposed to graduate in 85.
I remember seeing you on campus.
Come on.
Yeah. We hung out in front of Hamilton House one time.
Hamilton House.
It was up on Comm Ave where it splits with Beacon Street.
What the fuck was I doing up there? Hamilton, that's why.
For answers.
West Campus.
Yeah. Well, above West Campus.
Yeah. I remember, I'll talk Boston because I'm trying to keep my memories together before they all go away.
I know.
Because I texted you yesterday. That must have been a weird text. Can you just confirm that Billy Downs was the guy that booked the Comedy Connection? A place where I never worked, really.
Billy Downs not only booked the Comedy Connection, but he had a bunch of one-nighters.
What was the parrot one?
New England. The something parrot.
Yeah. What was that one? I did that with that big. You remember that comic, the big dude? He was kind of goofy and he always wore a Hawaiian shirt. The fuck was that guy's name? He always wore like a Hawaiian shirt. Nice
DJ
guy.
DJ Hazard?
No, not DJ. It was
the guy with the motorcycle? Kind of like a burly guy?
But a real nice guy. He wasn't a burly personality. No. I can't remember the guy's name. I don't know if he even lived.
But Bill Downs was a guy that used to book you and then not necessarily pay you. And so Bill Downs was called No Money Downs. And and then after he owed you a certain amount of money, he would do this buyout thing where you felt like you were never going to get paid.
Yeah.
So he'd give you 60 cents on the dollar.
And that was just a way of doing business.
Yeah, because it was all cash.
And what the fuck were we going to do?
We had no agents.
Start shit with a booker?
Right. So here's what I did. He owed me about $1,200, which does not sound like a lot of money right now. Back then, that was 4 months' rent.
That's a lot of money.
So I go up to do a gig in New Hampshire at one of his shows. Because the gigs were all just like...
Which one was that one?
Hampton Beach... It was a Chinese restaurant. Yeah, it was always a Chinese restaurant that had a banquet room in the back.
I was trying to remember the names of these places. I just want to do that the whole time. All right, it's Hampton Beach. Chinese restaurant with the room in the back.
And so I show
up. Function room.
And I, yeah, there's like every when the comedy boom started, they realized that Chinese restaurants all had banquet rooms.
Yeah.
All they had to do, comedy was so hot.
Right.
Hang a sign out front that says Comedy Tuesday Night and then just start charging tickets.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they paid us, the headliner was getting $200.
Yeah.
The feature would get $75, the opener would get $25.
Right.
So for less than $300, they would charge 200 people $15 a head.
Yeah.
What Do the racket. Math.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the marketing was hanging the sign out front. There was no advertising budget. And so
you never knew what you're driving into, man.
So I get to this gig, and before I go on stage, I go, oh, Billy, I said I was the feature act.
Yeah.
I go, I forgot my watch. I don't want to go long. Can I borrow your watch? So he gives me his gold watch.
Billy Downs.
Wait,
he was up there? Was it like the first night of it or something?
That's the thing about these gigs. These guys would show up in person because they didn't want the ticket taker. It was all cash. They wanted that money in their hand.
Wow.
So I get to watch. I finish my set. I dart out the side door and I go home. And the next day I get a call and he goes, hey, big guy.
Yeah.
Everybody's big guy.
Yeah.
You forgot to give me my watch back last night. And I go, no, Billy, you forgot to pay me $1,200. And he goes, okay, you got me, guy. And so I said, all right, meet me at Dunkin' Donuts in Kenmore Square.
Yeah.
Brown bag, cash. Let's do this.
Yeah.
And he met me, and he looked at me with full respect, one shyster to another.
Yeah.
And I got the money.
You met him where he lives.
Yeah.
Oh, I think the very first paid gig I did was for Mike Clark, the Derby Pack. The Derby Pack in Lowell.
Yeah.
And I opened for Chris Shino.
Yeah.
And it was just like, it was like, there was kind of a stage, but there was like a brass railing around it.
Yeah.
And it was up in the corner. And I was just, I was thrilled to be in Lowell, I think.
Of course, where Jack Kerouac is.
That's
from.
Right. You know, but like there I was in this shitty bar, and all I remember at that place, there was always a woman up front talking to you like she was, you know, in conversation with you. You know, you do your bits, and she's like, that's not right.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of how I sum up comedy in Boston, is there is no implicit understanding that because you're on stage, you're the funniest person in the room. You have to prove it every time. You have to assert alpha dominance on
the room. Dude, I don't know how the fuck I did it.
It made you a better comic, though.
Of course. I mean, the way we paid our dues— when everyone is out there doing opening slots, it's like you get thrown into that thing, and it's like you got to do a half hour. Yeah. The other guy does 45.
Yeah,
there was no There was no 10-minute spot.
Yeah,
when you started working there in those one nighters, you had to have a half somehow.
Yeah,
right. But wait, like, so what year did you start?
88, 89.
So that was the year that I came in second in the riot.
The riot.
Yeah, it was Sue McGinnis took first.
She was great.
Was she?
Yeah, she was great.
She's a sweetheart.
She had this bit about going on a date with a guy.
Oh, and the shitting bit?
She shit in the toilet and then, wouldn't flush.
And she put it in a napkin, put it in her purse.
And then the guy's dog was sniffing around her purse.
She was sweet.
Well, what was that house you lived in Cambridge with all the other comedians? We cross and—
Oh, that was Bob Wilson's house.
That house was
dude.
Nuts.
It was the Loser Museum. It was like, you know, it was whatever was left by any number of comics that lived there. There was some great moments in that fucking house.
Well, that's where cross comedy sort of germinated, didn't it?
Yeah, I kind of started, you know, I think I was there with him developing that. I was on the first one, and I helped come up with the idea. But when they decided to, like, all move to L.A. to become, you know, bona fide
Mr.
comedy
Show.
Stars, I'm like, I'm going to New York.
Yeah.
I'm going to fucking hammer it out as a stand-up. I don't like this groupthink shit.
All right.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good choice.
I remember being in that house once.
Oh, God, there were some great moments
in
that
house. And I
remember
you were on the phone in the hallway.
Uh-huh.
I guess it was one
there
phone
There was a phone,
the
right. It ran from the kitchen.
Yeah, and you were and you were in there, and everybody was like, shut up.
Yeah.
Mark's on the phone with Bud Friedman.
Oh, my God. Really?
Like, we were like, wow.
Yeah, I don't even remember that call.
Yeah.
That's the impact it had. The things I remember about that place, because I would sleep in, I didn't really have a house, and I wasn't really living there. in my recollection, I don't know why, but because I must have been living in New York or some, coming back and forth, but I would sleep in Dave's room when he was sleeping at his girlfriend's, or I'd sleep on that fucking couch in the living room surrounded by Bob's life.
Yeah.
The records, the tapes. There's always like these porn tapes, and then there was like hundreds of records and all kinds of shit. Carl Perry was living there. Do you remember that guy?
No.
Matt Graham.
Yeah, Matt Graham.
Matt Graham was there.
A backgammon champion now.
Scrabble.
Oh, Scrabble.
And, oh, there was just some fucking moments there. One night, you know, me and Graham were there. It was after everything had closed down because he was a fucking drinker, dude.
Yeah.
And we're fucked up. And we're sitting in that kitchen table and we're grinding up Vivrin.
Jesus.
To snort it.
Yeah.
Just a fucking over-the-counter.
Speed.
Yeah, but it's not even speed, it's caffeine pills.
Yeah.
But we're fucking shit-faced. And we're grinding it up and it's yellow and it's this powder and we're snorting it. And it's not going to do anything. And Bob walks in from his restaurant job. He walks in the kitchen, he looks at us and goes, I'm not going to tell anyone about this. And then there was the other time because Carl had problems, right?
Yeah.
And, he was in an institution of some kind to get sober or something. And I just remember it was the most brilliant thing. There's a couple of moments where people say things off the cuff where I'm like, where the fuck did that come from? And it was like, I was in the living room and I asked Matt, I said, is Carl going to get out soon? And Matt goes, not unless Chief can lift the sink.
That's great. That's hilarious. That's great. No, when I speaking of opening for people, I had, because the thing is, when you were starting out, if you had a driver's license and you had 15, 20 minutes,
Dude, you
could make a living. You could go out and make 25, 50 bucks a night.
Right.
But rent was only 250.
Yeah.
So you
might have to drive a couple hours.
But that's my point. If you, none of the headliners had driver's license. They all had DUIs. So you would have to pick up.
Half criminals. Yeah.
So you would have to pick them up. So at one point, Dominic Ventri, the guy at the Knicks Comedy Stop. He goes, you got to pick up a couple comics and bring them out to Framingham. They had a Knicks in Framingham.
Briefly, I remember that room.
So I go downtown.
Yeah.
And I've got a four-cylinder Volkswagen Rabbit.
Yeah.
It's a four-speed. And I pull up to the club and out walks the two comics.
Yeah.
John Panette.
Yeah.
And Mike Sullivan Irwin. You remember him?
I do. He was a nice guy.
He was a great guy.
Yeah.
Bigger than John Panette.
Really?
And Panette was a good 325.
Michael Sullivan Irving with the ponytail.
He had a ponytail. Yeah, blonde hair.
Yeah. Nice guy.
So they pile into my car. They look at my car. They look at each other, and they just start giggling like children. They get in the car, and I'm driving it, and I'm supposed to get on the Mass Pike right downtown. And I can't get the car out of second gear.
Yeah.
And so I had to take Route 9 instead of the
turnpike.
Because
of the weight?
Yeah, it took like an hour to get out there because I had to take Route 9.
Oh, my God. I remember one time I'm driving around with, do you know Eddie Gosling from Texas?
Yeah.
He used to be big.
Uh-huh.
And like he got lean. But when I first met him, he was like huge.
Yeah.
And he drove, it was like a little, like a Toyota truck or something. I don't remember what it was. But he's packed into that driver's seat and we're going to get barbecue. And every time he would turn, the horn would go, and I said, what the fuck's wrong with your car? He goes, my fucking stomach. Oh, my God, dude. I guess
we went down to that gig. No, we went to the actual sub base in, I think it's Groton, Connecticut, right next to there. And it was 1991.
Yeah.
And I'm with John Groff. And we get a call like a week before the gig.
Yeah.
And this is when it was imminent. The first Iraq war was about to happen.
Yeah.
The strikes.
Yeah.
So they call us and they get our social security numbers. They ask us like a million questions to get clearance to get on the base because they're on high alert.
Right.
So we're driving down. We're listening to a Red Sox game on the radio. And then they cut in to say the attacks have started.
Oh, no.
And so we're halfway down. We pull over to a payphone and we call up Denise Kirk, who's booking the gig.
Sure.
And we say, we're assuming turn around.
Yeah.
And she's like, I just called them. Keep going. We get to the base. We get to the check-in.
Yeah.
And they look in the car. They ask us a million questions. We get in, and there's the rec room, and there's two rooms. One has a big screen TV,
yeah,
and everybody's watching TV, and it's
the war.
It's the war. Bush is addressing the nation.
Yeah.
You know, CNN is. And in the other room is the stand-up comedy room.
Right.
And so we walk in, and they announce that the show is starting, and literally every single soldier left the TV room and came into the comedy room. And we had the most killer fucking show.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because they didn't know what was going to happen tomorrow.
Well, or they did.
Yeah.
They didn't need to hear all this because they were already downloaded on everything that was about to happen. And they wanted to have a laugh before they went off to...
Great show.
Yeah, it was a great show.
Oh, my God.
John Groff, who, you know, was one of those comics in Boston that was a little too smart for a lot of these rooms.
Yeah, he was a smart guy. I think Brown. I gave him his first writing
Brown,
job.
Right? Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
On
short attention span theater.
No kidding.
When I was such a fucking nightmare on that show, but they didn't have a real writer there. Well, the guy, I don't want to diss the guy more than I have my entire life. But yeah, and I pulled John in. I don't remember the guy's name. I think his name was Danny Aronson. I don't know what he went on to do, but.
I know that John, I guess he wrote for you, and then he wrote for the Jon Stewart show and got fired.
Mm.
And then went on to become, he's literally one of the biggest showrunners in Hollywood right now.
Oh, I know,
he's
Is he
brilliant
still?
Sitcom writer. Oh, yeah. It's not everything. He was doing Blackish.
He was doing Blackish, yeah. He became, but he was always one of those guys that, you know, not like the rest of us broken fucking idiots. Like, there was always a sense that, you know, somehow or another, those guys who are like reasonably parented, have a good education, they're going to find a way to rise to, you know, a place of power and success.
Yes.
Where the rest of us just pushed back on that.
Yes.
I couldn't.
Well, yeah, because I think for me, comedy was, I was in school and I was not going to be told what to do. I looked down on people that did well in school. And I think it's because I came from a really shitty public school. And so there was the default setting was, if you try, you're a loser.
Oh, and really? So, neighborhood. That's neighborhood idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I...
Where'd you grow up?
In New York, in Westchester County.
Oh, not in Boston.
No. Everybody thinks Boston because I went to school there.
And you're fucking Irish as fuck.
And I'm Irish. I check a lot of boxes for Boston.
Yeah, dude. Yeah.
And so... So I think that comedy became a thing that was just such a natural fit. And so I had that same mentality going into stand-up. I hated the guys that were, and the women, there were very few in Boston.
Yeah.
That's why I say guys, because that's who we started with.
I could probably name all the women.
Sue McGinnis, Maria Falzone.
Right. Laura Dombrowski.
Lauren Dombrowski.
What was that one's name? Hogue? Stephanie, what was her
Stephanie
name?
Stephanie Hogue.
Was that her name? Yeah.
Barr. What was it? Julie Barr.
She
was great.
Yeah.
She passed. There weren't a lot.
Janine and Laura Keitlinger.
Yeah. Garofalo and Keitlinger. And Sarah actually spent some time there.
Wendy Liebman.
Wendy Liebman. We're forgetting.
Wendy Liebman.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think I fell in with the comics that were, I don't know, I just fell into that camp of, like, I did gravitate to the Gavin guys who just had attitude, who were very much, like, fuck you comics.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I learned a lot from watching him. People always say when you're a comedian, there is, like, who are your influences? And people inevitably will say Pryor, whatever.
Right, right, right.
I always say Gavin first. He's the guy that I think I learned the most
from.
He's
a worker, man.
Yeah.
Like, I was down, I was with Gavin at Johnny Yee's once. I was opening or middling, whatever the structure was. And after that show, we were in a hotel room playing that fucking dollar bill poker game.
Yeah.
And I just watched him getting more and more fucked up.
White Russians.
Oh, white Russians, you know, blow. And like one eye was closing. And he's like, I got to pay once. You know, whatever the fuck the game was. But when you work with those guys.
Well, Gavin one time was at Nick's and he had a couple dozen white Russians.
Yeah.
And then he goes on at the end and he comes off stage and one of the younger comics goes, Don, you repeated the same joke twice.
Yeah.
And Don looks at him and he goes, records five.
Ha ha ha. But when you were hanging out with those guys, you couldn't leave.
No, why would you leave?
Well, I mean, because you might want to go to bed.
Yeah.
But you know, once you're in it after a gig or you're hanging out,
yeah.
You know, you've got to wait until they fucking pass out.
Right, right.
And then you're like, oh, finally.
Yeah.
And go back to my room.
I remember the Laughing Lobster up in Maine. It was me, Tom Cotter, and Kevin Knox.
Knoxie.
And we drive up there, and it's a condo, so it's exactly that. And Knoxie, and we're bringing women back to the condo every night because it was a resort. It was filled with like French Canadian women and American women, and so we're hooking up. And so there's a pool, and we're going to go down to the pool.
Yeah,
beautiful day out, and it's all these French Canadian women, and they're beautiful.
Yeah.
And the pool's packed, and I was like, fuck, man, I forgot to bring a bathing suit.
Yeah.
And so Kevin goes, well, you got some boxer shorts? I go, yeah. He goes, just wear the fucking boxer shorts.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
So they go down to the pool, and I'm sitting there debating it. And I was like, oh, God, all right, fuck it. I'm going down there. I put on the boxer shorts.
Yeah.
I walk into the pool area. I open the gate. They're sitting on the far side of the pool. I close the gate. I take two steps in, and Knoxie stands up, and he goes, Greg, what are you wearing your underwear for? And the whole pool just laughs at me. I turn around. I go back to the condo.
Those fucking guys. Tom Rhodes talks about being on an elevator with John Fox.
Yeah.
It was like a packed elevator, and Fox just blows a fart out, and it's the worst. And immediately he's like, Jesus, Tom, what'd you eat? You know? Becca. Why is it so funny?
Oh,
the fucking life
God.
We live.
Because we started out, there was no social media. We had our days free.
We used the Wild West.
You used to play softball with us, right? I mean, like Mondays and Wednesdays and Fridays, there was a softball game at noon.
Yeah.
And we had full size. We had 18 players that would show up. Everybody's hungover. We bust each other's balls. We'd laugh. Sometimes there'd be a fight. I remember who got into a fight one. It might have been Matt Graham,
actually.
It was Matt Graham.
And like, he's so competitive, dude.
And so we would go to movies. We would, you know, hang out late after the shows. There was no promotion. There was just writing new stuff.
I just remember just getting back to Catch a Rising Star for the free booze.
Yeah.
That was the craziest thing, that they just wouldn't charge comics for booze.
Yeah.
So even if people didn't work there, you know, after like gigs, it just we packed.
Yeah.
Get shit faced.
Yep. And I remember doing shows there and, Barry Crimmins would just police the back of the room. He would walk back and forth, and he'd watch if you were on stage. And if you said something that was hacky, he would go, hack!
Ugh, I miss that.
Oh my God. I was
around for the comics getting on the back mic time.
Oh, yeah.
When there was no management, and like on those showcase nights, you know, you'd, in the middle of your set, someone would just be like, oh, that wasn't, you know, whatever. This fucking nightmare and the ever-evolving list that Robin Horton was constantly creating as the night went on. Just watching your name be bumped further and further down.
Yeah, I remember.
Fuck.
I auditioned for that guy. And, it, you know, like you said, the stakes were so high that the five-minute set that you were getting, and that's what the audition was 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I waited for months to get it. And I finally go in, I do the 5 minutes, and I get off stage and I just look at him.
Yeah.
And I go, so what do you think? And he goes, well, I can either tell you, I can take you in the back and tell you, or I can just tell you to come back in 6 months. Ugh. And of course, I'm like, no, I want you to tell me.
Yeah.
So we go in the back and he literally said, as far as I'm concerned, you're just another cocky Irish puke.
Uh-huh.
It's the first time I experienced real racism as an Irish guy before.
But he wasn't wrong.
I've ridden that all the way to the middle, Mark.
I don't know how you didn't name that your first album, with Cocky Irish Puke.
That actually would be great. Yeah.
He just had to read on you. I think the problem was the word puke.
I mean,
you know what I mean?
Cocky little Irish. Well, you know, you grew up small. You gotta compensate.
So you went to school at BU and you're from New York and you just stayed in Boston?
Yeah, stayed in Boston.
When did you quit drinking?
I'd been doing comedy about a year, so I quit in 91.
How bad did that get?
Well, my father was a really bad alcoholic. So for me, I had kind of a shallow bottom.
Yeah.
You know, like I spent 3 weekends in jail for fighting. And
that's pretty good. That's a substantial bottom.
But it was also, I was a good drunk, though. I mean, I was a guy who, yeah, I got into fights because I had a bad temper. But I also was like, I was fun. I was a good, fun drunk, as my dad was.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't a lot of my friends going like, you know, as they're shit-faced and doing blow going, hey, man, you don't have a problem. You know, I'm worse than you.
Right.
It's like, well, yeah, that's going to be something you're going to confront at some point.
Maybe.
And so I got out. I just remember I kept a lot of journals throughout my life. And
really?
I go back and I read my journals from college.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of, I need to quit drinking.
Really?
There was a lot of times where I just felt like, and I think a lot of it was not wanting, there was so many scenes with my father.
Yeah.
There was so many moments where as a child I was humiliated and angry and scared. And I just thought to myself, that's not the life that I want for myself. So I think I was highly sensitive to those feelings.
Did he die from it?
Well, he died at 53 of a heart attack from smoking, but the drinking was part of it. He smoked 3.5 packs a day.
Oh, my God. Yeah. What'd that guy do?
He was a radio guy.
I think I knew that.
Yeah, he was a big radio guy in New York. He was like one of the biggest guys.
Really? What was his name?
Bob Fitzsimmons.
On what channel?
WNEW.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you grew up with that?
Yeah. Yeah, we grew up.
What was his show? Drive Time?
He did some Drive Time, but he was mostly afternoon. He was political. He was kind of a bleeding heart liberal.
And
Mayor Koch used to, when he had the morning show, Mayor Koch used to call in every single morning.
Oh, really?
And they would kind of go at it.
How am I doing?
Yeah. Is this good, Fitzy? And so they would go at it, talk about politics, talk about what was in the news that day. And it was kind of where Koch learned how to do radio, because then he later had his own radio show.
Yeah.
But he did a thing in the 70s, that late 70s, early 80s, he called the Feminine Forum because he had the daytime shift.
Yeah.
And they realized the demographic was all housewives.
Right.
So before Donahue did this, he started talking about menopause. He talked about, you know, being cheated on. He talked about, you know, the Feminine Forum.
Right.
And it was, and he got a lot of, he got shut down by the FCC a couple times.
For what?
Indecency. He was talking about things that were unacceptable to talk about on the radio
in
at
the
that
afternoon.
Time.
Yeah,
and so, but he, you know, he had a career where I saw him go. I would see him go for a year, year and a half with no job, and the drinking would get really bad, and it was scary. And I think it set me up for a career where, number one, I saw that I could do something for a living that was creative.
Right.
I loved watching him. He would MC. Like charity nights. Anybody asked him to MC a charity night, he loved it. He put on a tuxedo. I've got an envelope full of his bullet points for his material.
Is that the new special?
That's the new special, yeah. Old cocky Irish puke. And he would go up and kill, and he'd do crowd work, and he would talk about the moment. He would talk about what was going on. And I think it was really where I thought maybe you know, this is what I could do. But I saw also that it can all go away
instantly.
Immediately. And I think I have an unhealthy relationship to that. After having done it now 35 years, that I still have these feelings that the bottom's going to fall out and, you know, worried about money, which I don't need to worry about. Like it's
what'd you do? Bank the money from writing?
Writing, you know, and I had those silly development deals early on that we got.
But
you know.
You were responsible at your money?
Oh, very responsible.
And your wife worked?
Nope, she didn't work.
Yeah, you did all right, huh?
Yeah. That's the writing was good, and then I've just always worn a lot of hats. I've never said no to anything.
But also, if you're not greedy and weird, and your objective is to, you know, buy things, you know, if you're responsible with money, you can live.
Yep.
You know, I never spend money.
Yeah.
And I never did. And I'm not.
I drive a Prius. It's a 12-year-old Prius.
I drive an Avalon. It's a little better. But it's a, you know,
bragging with an Avalon.
Yeah, I'm bragging. Because I love it. I love the car. The only time I don't love my car is when I park at the Comedy Store and I watch what these fuckers come in with.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, how do they? And then it took me the longest time to realize, like, they're just leasing it, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, people would drive in cars. You're like, what the fuck is that?
Right.
How does that guy?
Tim Dillon pulled in a half million dollar Rolls Royce the other night.
That was too much.
But you know what? He's enjoying it. I love it
that he gets out of that Rolls Royce SUV with his fucking filthy T-shirt on.
Exactly. Like
he must have like a bunch of filthy T-shirts.
Yeah.
Like it's his look.
But you know what? The guy is fucking crushing it and he's enjoying the money. And I think for some people, he's also really smart with real estate. So as much as he's blowing it, he's got a place in the Hamptons. He's got a place in Austin. And
he kept that place in Austin?
I think so. Mm. Yeah. So I think it drives some people to keep working hard if they just, Louis like that. He's always spending more than he makes.
You don't got to tell me.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fucking nuts.
Yeah.
The stories about him, you know, making himself broke are the best.
Yeah. Right.
And he's always been that way.
Yeah.
Just like get to zero to push yourself.
And buy cameras,
put a car on your Amex.
Buy a motorcycle and then leave it on the street in New York so it gets impounded and you owe money on it week after week.
Yeah. I am just not that guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I like knowing I have the money in the bank, but I would get, you know, overwhelmed with anxiety and also just sort of overwhelmed with the, you know, the feeling of things weren't going to work out and, you know, how am I going to live with that?
Yeah.
But then I do it on stage.
Yeah, I think stage is a good, that's how I've dealt with my depression. I have depression. I'm medicated for it. Yeah, I've had, I know nobody can believe it, but I think I'm, when I'm alone, it gets bad. If I'm around people, I'm okay.
Because you've got like this weird even keel that only implies two things, of depression or just fury.
I think I got both.
Yeah. Like, it's like, you know, because you have this way about, you know, that cocky Irish puke business where it's just sort of like, you know, I'm going to get stuck here. I don't know how I'm going to go up and say hi to him, but it's not going to land. It's not going to be great.
Like, wait, if I'm even, how is that not great?
If you're what? Even? No, but there's like, you have this sort of like this, you know, a very kind of innate passive aggressive thing that you do.
Yes.
And you think you're, you know, for some people, it might blow by them. But for someone overly sensitive by me, like when you introduce me, if I'm going on after you, 99% of the time I'm walking out there going, that little fuck, he just took a shot at me. I don't know if you noticed that, but I noticed it because I know exactly what he did there.
I was shocked. That happened about 3 times ago. And here's exactly what I said. I said, this next guy coming up is doing it as good as anybody else. Is that passive aggressive?
Isn't it? What does that even mean? How about, like, this guy's a funny guy. This guy's is doing as good as anyone. So people, during the intro, they got to go like, what does that mean? You could tell me that was like just earnest, pleasant intro.
I fucking hate that system of bringing up the next act.
Oh,
because you can't win. Either you're being too general and saying they've been on Comedy Central and they've got a new special on YouTube, you know, and they just go like, all right, he just made that up. Or you try to get personal, and then it gets into that territory where now they're thinking about your intro.
Weird things where you kind of like, you're just kind of riffing the intro, and like I've had brought people on. This guy used to be on a show that got canceled.
Right.
That kind of thing.
You brought me up one night, and you said, and you later apologized. You texted me later and apologized.
Oh.
And you said, this next guy is aging and shrinking. He seems to be shrinking. And now I got to walk on stage, and I got to process that. I got to react to you. I just drove from Venice to make $20. I got a pocket full of new jokes I'm going to try, and now that's half my set.
Do I have to apologize again?
No, it was a nice apology.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, like, I can't, because I do that instinctively, too. Like, I, you know, there's people that, you know, there's certain people that, like, are just innately defensive.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they're just like, I'm going to, I don't know what's going to happen. Even with the nicest guys, I'm going to fuck him before he fucks me. This guy's got no ill intention.
I'm like, fight.
What's the angle? You know, where, how you.
Yeah.
And a lot of stuff as I get older, it just doesn't, it's like old habits, like a phantom limb. You know, you do it and then you're like, what the fuck did I?
I also think we hate boredom.
Yeah.
I hate a small talk interaction that has nothing behind it. So if I can say something that's a little bit, you know, going to throw somebody off a tiny bit and that's going to open up the juices,
it's
going to be a better conversation.
Yeah, for you.
Yeah, for you too. You're the same way.
I don't throw a wrench in immediately. And I've learned to listen because I've been doing this for so long.
No.
You know.
Your first move is to cock your head back and look down through the bottom of your glasses.
Yeah, yeah.
And go,
what's going on?
What's going on? We good? Everything all right?
To you.
You do it to everybody.
I'm not going
to
do that to Fahim.
Yes, you do it to Fahim.
That's probably true.
Yes.
What's going on with you?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's certain people that you don't have to do that to. You know, they're genuinely nice guys. But yeah, sometimes, like, and I know that, like, I come off as dickish, but I'm really not. I just don't know. Because there are some people, you know, that were, like, you don't want to mention names, but there are just some people where you're like, what are you even doing up there?
You stand-up wise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't even register I don't know what you're doing. And then, like, you know, but there is some part of me where it's like, we're not on the same playing field.
Mm-hmm.
Are we?
Mm-hmm.
But it's always been that way. And I think that's been a big liability for me. Because if I'm feeling insecure, I'll be like, oh, this guy's getting fucking laughs. What's that about?
I think that that's a good driver.
I guess.
I think it's always been helpful for me to look at other comics.
But then people think you're a dick.
Well, so what?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, does that bother you that people think you're a dick?
No, because at this point in my life, I don't think I am.
Uh-huh.
And when I was a dick, you know, I'll take it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I also think that not unlike any of us, you know, you get resentments for whatever it is.
Right.
You make assumptions about people. And then some people, like, gossip and start shit.
Uh-huh.
And I just think because I'm, you know, I seem to have an air of people read as an air of condescension.
Right.
But it's really, I'm just thinking about me. I'm not, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think that, it's just my particular, I'm a, you know, a cocky, kikey puke.
I tried to fight you once. Do you remember that?
Oh, my God.
Luna Lounge in New York.
Really?
Louis broke it up.
What?
You said something. There was a New York Times piece about me because I was hosting a game show. And I hit you
where it hurt, huh?
And I had done Letterman. And I was having a really good time that I was feeling really good about.
Mm.
And then you just fucking went after me at Luna.
On stage?
No, backstage in that bar, front bar.
Right.
And I lunged at you and Louis jumped in. And stopped it from happening.
Are you sure?
100%.
What did I say?
At one point, you asked me to show you my teeth.
Yeah.
Like, because I was going to go out to L.A.
Oh, like you're putting yourself on the market.
Yeah. Which was always funny to me because you resenting that was like, you didn't want that. You didn't want to be on a sitcom.
Of course I did on some level. But I had decided that, you know, I'd rather be angry about it and choose a position of, like, you sell out.
Yeah.
Then admit that my own sort of aspirations around it.
Right.
Because I was stuck in this world of angry comedy.
Yeah.
Where you weren't trying to be appealing.
Right.
To everybody.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I did that, huh? And you lunged at me. I'm not a fighter, so it wouldn't have gone very far.
No, I think the reason is, well, there's a couple dynamics. One is that I think I grew up with a dominating father who I was very... I think I let him dictate how I felt about myself.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think that you know, you have a very strong personality. And
right.
Also, I always respected your stand-up.
Right.
So I think your opinion meant more to me than I would have liked.
Right. Yeah. I feel that. I get that. But I, you know, like, it's weird. I can't remember the last time where I have felt that type of anger where somebody has said or done something where I can't kind of control. Like, you know, where it comes up
and you
can't manage it.
Yeah.
I haven't felt that in a while.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes people bring people up and I'm like, oh, that fucking, you know, uh-huh. That'll happen.
Yeah.
But directed at me, yeah. I think I've learned how to absorb. I can take a hit pretty good now. And I'm all right.
Yeah.
If it's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a chess match, isn't it?
But we're old, dude.
Yeah,
How long does this have to fucking go on for?
I just had I do a Sunday morning yoga on the beach in Santa Monica.
You still live in Venice?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm driving there on Sunday morning, and I'm on Abbot Kinney, and it's quiet.
Yeah.
And so I'm driving, and this guy just Abbot Kinney's it across the street, just walks, you know, slowly.
Yeah.
And I don't slow down. Because that's who I still have to be at 58 years old. And so he has to jump out of the way. But he looks like a douche, so I don't fucking care.
Right.
So I pull up a couple lights, and then all of a sudden the car pulls up next to me, and it's the guy. And he's fucking screaming. He's kind of a tough guy, and he's screaming at me. And I'm going, well, I'm fucking, I go, you're jaywalking, whatever. And then his girlfriend jumps out of the car, and I was like, oh, here we go. Now she's going to hit me, and what am I supposed to do if she hits me?
Yeah.
And she's taking pictures of my license plate and taking a picture of me. And then he pulls in front of me, and I was just like, oh, is he going to hit my car now?
Yeah,
And then he pulls up, and, you know, 5 minutes later, I'm on a yoga mat, and the teacher's talking about how we should stay centered. And I'm like, I don't think that's going to happen for the next hour.
I'm not there.
Yeah.
But do you feel shitty about it?
There's a part of me that feels like, and this is a very Irish thing, that I'm supposed to right the wrongs in the universe. And that guy jaywalking makes me angry because I don't like that people
do that
to cars.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And I'm going to be the guy that doesn't put up with it. Yeah. And that's what's gotten me into most every fight I've been in my life is because I saw somebody be mean to somebody else.
Yeah.
Mistreat somebody else. And then that's when I snap. If they do it to me, it's like I can kind of orchestrate like some peace.
Joke your way out of it.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
But when it's somebody else, that's when I absolutely
you step in and you're like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
Really?
Right. Right.
So what, you know, I watched a special and, you know, the bits and pieces that like are pulled from your aging life.
Yeah.
Are kind of interesting in that like, You just went to Ireland?
Yeah, last summer.
For the first time?
No, like the fifth time.
Oh.
Yeah.
What's your experience when you go there?
It's like something in my DNA goes, this is where you're from. These
really?
Are your people. Yeah.
It's weird. I had this experience in Ireland. When I first moved to Boston to do comedy, I was terrified of the Boston Irish.
Uh-huh.
And they were surrounding me. Mm. And they were scary and loud and they were violent.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, like, it terrified me for a long time.
Yeah.
Because I had to perform for them. Mm-hmm. And it was always sort of like, I'm going to fucking, these fucking guys, they don't shut up. They're going to hit me. It's just a fucking nightmare.
Right.
And the first time I went to Ireland, the funny thing is that all the Irish there, they look like those guys, mm-hmm. but they couldn't be nicer.
Couldn't be nicer.
And it took me a while to adapt. Like, how you doing? Like, yeah, very sweet. And I'm like, what the fuck did the States do to fucking Irish people?
I mean, yeah, no, you go to Southie, the only books those guys, they'll hit you with a book, but the Irish are the most literate, the vocabulary of the average Irish person, five times as many words are in play.
Yeah. No, it's just a lovely place. I have this very a real affinity for it. For a long time, I thought I wanted to live there just because there's something about the kind of dark, poetic spirit of the place that I just love. But obviously, we know what Boston did to the Irish. I mean, they were treated like shit for years.
Mm-hmm. And the church. I mean, the thing is about the violence from the Irish, a lot of it is the complete oppression, the shame that was given to you.
Yeah.
And the feeling that, like, you had to bow down to this priest who you watched him every Sunday and you went, this guy isn't shit. I got to be afraid of this guy.
Yeah.
I think I don't know what else happened to the Irish here, but it really is like, I go to the St. Patrick's Day parade. I went every year. I used to march with all four of my grandparents are from Ireland.
Yeah.
So I would march with my grandfather, Florence McCarthy.
Yeah.
And he was with the Ancient Order of Hibernians in the Bronx.
Yeah.
And we would walk through the St. Patrick's Day parade since I was like 5 years old.
Yeah.
And I just had, to this day, I get teary-eyed when I hear the pipes and the drums and I see the Irish faces, the pale skin and the black hair, the redheads, and I see the pride they have, and I see I've got this great picture. I'll show it to you. I'm on a text chain with a bunch of my grandfather's family.
Yeah.
They're all over the country, and I got this shot. I never knew this, but my grandfather went out to Montana where his brother lived, and there was 13 brothers and sisters, and so there was about six of them in Montana, and there's a picture of them, and you know, this is in like the 1930s, so it's a black and white shot, and they're all dressed in their suits. Because they're in Montana, so they're wearing a fucking suit.
Right.
And they're all laughing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it was always there. That story, I can remember my grandfather, my mom inherited my grandfather's laugh, and it is musical. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And you know, I feel like that's how we dealt with it.
Yeah. And when you go there, do you have people there?
Yeah.
You have relatives.
Yeah. There. I had some show up. I did a show in Galway.
Yeah.
There's a great little theater. If you ever go to Galway, I'll put you in touch with the guy.
Yeah.
And it's the Roisin Dove. And that's where Tommy Tiernan works out a lot. He lives in Galway.
Yeah.
And so a bunch of my cousins showed up. I didn't know I had. And they were not that distant. They were like second cousins once removed something like that.
Yeah.
And they saw me and the love and the acceptance and the joy.
Yeah.
They had come that day and they'd heard I was coming and they waited all day.
Yeah.
And it was just... You know, I've always had a good experience with my Irish relatives.
It's so good that, like, you do an act that's pretty foolproof. Like, you know, your jokes are tight.
Mm.
Like, you know, I've always got this fear, like, I'm going to tank in front of my family because I never know where some of my jokes are going to end up.
Yeah.
But it's nice to be able to, like, do a good show and then everyone's like, yeah, you're funny. Yeah. Like, every time I walk off stage, there's family. I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't know. That one got away from me, man.
Well, it's also you're showing the world maybe some stuff that they'd rather keep secret. If not stories, just a general attitude.
Yeah.
Don't show them we're like that.
Yeah. Getting off stage after some of the stuff I do, I'm like, you okay? You know,
right.
And so you bring the whole family when you go?
Yeah, I had my mother, my kids, my wife, my brother.
Your mom's still around?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, how old is she?
She's 82. She never even dated after my father died. He was such a big personality.
Yeah.
I think like she went out with like two guys for like a month each.
Yeah.
And just she didn't match what she'd felt with my dad. And so she spent her life, you know, very happily alone with good friends.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, she's slowing down. She had some heart surgery about a year and a half ago.
But mentally good?
Mentally very sharp.
That's good.
We do the crossword puzzles together.
Thank God. The mental thing is very important.
Yeah, I'm sorry about your mom.
My dad's got the dementia.
Oh, the dad, right.
My mom's like kind of falling apart as well, but she's not totally mentally losing it.
Right.
It's like brutal, dude. I mean, it's like...
Your material about your dad is so fucking great.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, my God. It's that crazy thing about jail.
Oh, yeah. That's just like came together as a real joke.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
It's too much. I talked to him yesterday. He's still a... got most of it left. I mean, that's not true. He when he knows he's going to talk to me, he can zone in. He knows who I am. He knows what I'm doing. You know, and his wife's, he's in the ventriloquist dummy phase of early dementia, where his wife basically just, he'll go like, yeah, well, where'd we eat? And I'll hear his wife go, we ate at the Olive Garden. Oh yeah, we ate the Olive Garden. I'm like, you seen any movies? Yeah, we did see some movies. She goes, we saw that one. We saw you. So
yeah. Martin Lewis.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So how old are the kids now?
23 and 20.
You really pulled it off. And they're good kids?
Good kids, yeah. My son just, he graduated a year ago. He just spent 6 months in Guatemala and Mexico. Just him and his buddy, he's fluent in Spanish because they went to a Spanish immersion school from kindergarten through high school. So we went down there and they took what they call chicken buses from town to town because it's like people sitting there with like a chicken in their lap.
Yeah.
And they call them chicken buses.
Yeah.
And just got to know locals and had adventures and, you know, had romances and climbed volcanoes and just had a blast. And now he's back and he's trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't you worry about him?
Well, I said I used to say on stage, my son's down in Mexico for 6 months, longer if we can't get the ransom money together. But no, he's a sharp kid. He grew up in Venice, you know, so he knows how to keep his guard up, and you know he's intelligent, and I don't worry about him. And at a certain point, you really do. I think the only way to parent is to let them go in the sense that you have to say, my child might die. This sounds dark, but you have to say, my child might die.
Yeah.
And accept that.
Right.
And then let them live their life the way they're going to.
That sounds like the beginning of an Irish novel.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the Irish thing. It must be.
Yeah.
to just be like, hey, you know, could get bad.
It could get bad.
And, be all right.
And there's nothing I can do about
what
it.
What about the other one?
She's great. She's kind of like she's working right now in my, I have a podcast studio that I work out of, and she's working over there. She wants to maybe go in that direction. So she's learning how to do the editing and the uploading, and she does the camera switching. And she
third generation radio.
Yeah. And my son actually had a radio show in college on the college radio station at DePaul.
But did they know your father?
Never knew him.
Wild.
Yeah. And it's funny because my daughter, who is very spiritual, she has been since she was like 8 years old. She just like, you know, we kind of like, my mom takes them to, my mom's devout Catholic. And she takes them, and she takes them to church.
Yeah.
And my daughter from the get-go just something transcendent went through her.
Yeah.
And so we go to churches. Like, she likes to go to churches. And, like, I remember when she was 10 and learning about, like, you know, the transfiguration of the body of Christ.
Yeah.
And the ascension and all that stuff. She was just fascinated. And once she was about 9 and she knelt down. We were at the Cathedral St. John the Divine in Harlem. And she knelt down in front of the candles. And she lit a candle, and then she folded her hands, and she put her head down, which I didn't even know she knew how to do.
Yeah.
And she sat there for like 10 minutes, and then she got up, and I go, what were you doing? And she goes, I was praying for your father. And I was just like, it was like a scene from The Exorcist. Like, what? So, I don't know. I think there's something about them that is ancient. They have a respect, very, very, very curious and respectful about the generations that came ahead of them.
Your kids are.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's nice. They must have got that from you or something.
Yeah, I think that family has always been the most important thing. I mean, it's such a cliche, but it really, truly is. Like, it, you know, I just look at what I've done with my family, and I realize that I broke the cycle. You know, my father both my parents used to hit me, and there was a lot of drinking, and there was a lot of making me feel bad about myself. And I don't blame my parents because I know they got that from their parents and the cycle. And the fact that I broke the cycle in my lifetime is probably the achievement I'm most proud of.
Because you were conscious of it the whole time.
Yes. I mean, it's why I quit drinking. I didn't want to keep that cycle going.
Yeah, but you quit drinking, but then, you know, you still had to get your personal life together. Made some bad choices.
Yeah. Yeah. Career-wise, definitely.
People-wise.
Yeah. But I also, I raised them to realize that crying was okay. I would cry in front of my kids. I would show them I was depressed and that I deal with it.
Yeah.
And not make mental illness a stigma. Because I know that it's in the genes. Like,
well, I like that you rationalize this as a positive. You know, like I cried in front of my kids. I was depressed in front of my kids because, you know, I wanted them to learn. You know, I couldn't.
Well, why do you think they respect where they came from? Their ancestors were all depressed alcoholics. Respect that. Now, when I showed them joy, we dance. Yeah. We always had dance parties.
Oh, good.
And the dinner table is a storytelling, ball busting time. Yeah.
It's a very funny idea, though. The completely fucked up parent is abusive and depressed and fucked up. And, you know, at the end of the day, just so like, I just want you to learn about, you know, what this is like.
Realize that this is you.
Yeah,
this is who you will become.
Yeah, this is it.
Yeah.
And your wife, I think, like, you know, you ride a line with some of the comedy, which is funny. And I think it's good, like, because I'm not, like, I don't think in joke form, right? So you're, you know, that's just your nature. You're going to structure jokes, and, you know, mine have to evolve. I'm always surprised when a joke reveals itself.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's like a real joke.
Right.
Is that element of surprise. But you ride a line with your wife, but you're ultimately very respectful. And I imagine that the dialogue around that stuff, she's got to be used to it, right?
Yeah, well, I've never denigrated her in my act at all. I might talk about her sexually.
Right.
But it's honest and straightforward. Right. But I've never said a negative thing about her. And so, because I think that if you do, Like people go, what, you never get angry at your wife? And I was like, yeah, but if I write a joke about it, I have to hone that joke and I have to work on that joke and I got to do it night after night. And then it becomes a mantra that something is negative in my marriage that's really not.
Right.
You know, and so I don't bring that up. And she is, look, she's an Upper West Side Jew. She grew up in New York City. She's very, very thick skin. And, you know, the thing I love about the Jewish culture is that it is honest. It is raw. You put it out there. You say what you're feeling.
Yeah.
And I think that she comes from that world.
Yeah.
And so she never took any of my jokes. First of all, she watches me do stand-up once a year.
Right.
Because I do this one show on St. Patrick's Day that you've been nice enough to do in the past. And she comes out and watches that. And then she has never listened to one of my podcasts in her life. So that's what keeps it healthy. She could give a shit.
And it sounds like you guys get along pretty good.
Get along great. We just had our 25th anniversary this week.
How old are you?
58.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, dude.
Not too late, Mark.
I know. But, like, it's sort of a miracle that you were able to hold the line in terms of your mental health and everything else. I mean, do you ever think about that? Like,
every day, it's a constant struggle. I go to therapy. I'm medicated. I meditate every day. I work out almost every day. I just try to be conscious of what I'm thinking. I try to not eat carbs, just little things.
Yeah, but it could have gone the other way. It's the amazing thing about, you know, being, you know, sober and like living it.
Yeah.
And taking responsibility for all that shit. But you're not a big program guy, right?
No, that's the thing I feel bad about. I really do. I wish I'd gone more along the lines that you did, because it's free therapy. It's a constant therapy.
To a level. You know, like, I just saw someone do a joke last night. It was a Maria Bamford joke. Because
uh-huh.
She's like did a bit about 12-step programs, about cults and whatever.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she would go to all these 12-step things. She's a genius.
Yeah.
And she brought her husband to one of the meetings.
Yeah.
And he sat there, and I guess in the middle of the meeting, he said, these people need professional help.
That's hilarious.
I mean, there is a context to, you know, it teaches you
how.
I
feel like that when I watch an improv show.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
But there is the context of the 12 steps relative to whatever your problem is, you know, can, you know, sort of dig into, you know, accepting that problem and then, you know, taking the steps necessary to become a relatively decent person.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because the idea is you're fundamentally self-centered. So you have to learn how to, you know, be of service or how to give or how to take responsibility for your problems, how to have some sort of spiritual idea that at least enables you to realize that, you know, you're not it.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are all helpful.
Right.
But to really get into the nuts and bolts of trauma or parental abuse, I mean, you really got to, you know, you're going to find common ground in the rooms.
Yeah.
But there's no solution other than you going like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I had that. Yeah, right. Well, I did Al-Anon for years.
That's right. So, you mentioned that.
So I am familiar with the 12. It's the same 12 steps.
Oh, no. I've done Al-Anon.
Yeah. Al-Anon is profound. I got a lot
it's
out of
deep,
it.
It's deep, dude.
Yeah,
it's a deeper program because it's trickier.
Yeah. The first time I walked
you're
into
Al-Anon.
You're
real
Al-Anon. Yeah.
You're like the king of detachment.
I don't engage emotionally with anybody. I learned that.
It's just like it's like a classic sort of Al-Anon disposition where you got a slight martyr thing, a little bit of passive aggression, but you know you know how to hold a boundary.
Here's what I love about you. You sum people up. When you like I watch you watch other comedians and I can see your mind going, "Oh, he's doing that." He's doing that.
Well,
he's
we've been
that.
Doing it so long.
Yeah.
And like, and now it's sort of like, even if you've heard something before, who cares?
Yeah.
What's more interesting is how do like, you know, generations sort of disappear and then they sprout up exactly the same types.
Right.
The same types.
Yep.
It's crazy to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do that a bit, but it's not so much judgmental. I am actually like, I'd like to laugh. You know what I mean? Like, I spent, you know, so many years doing comedy, and you get sort of numb to it.
Yeah,
so if there's a guy that can deliver the goods where I'm like, I'm excited if I'm like, I'm going to go watch this.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen that much.
Right, right.
It used to happen all the time, maybe because we were younger. And back then, you really didn't know what the fuck was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like back when we were coming up where people would lose their shit, yeah. You'd always, like, there was always somebody snapping.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, that was the best.
Yeah.
Jay Charbonneau just lost his shit again.
Oh, my God. Frank Santarelli.
Oh, Frank.
Frank would lose it.
Oh, he was, I love Frank.
Frank's the best.
He is.
But, you know, and Kevin Meaney, like, you know, watching Kevin Meaney bomb, like, to this day, nothing, first of all, him killing straight up is probably the hardest I've seen a group of people laugh in my life. He would fucking kill.
He'd push and push and push and push.
Holy, and he was doing it in character.
Yeah.
Which just takes the laughter to a whole, like, you watch Sebastian.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, his jokes are good, but they're not, like, the greatest jokes you've ever seen.
No,
but
it's the performance. It's the wind-up.
The
thing going with the thing.
Yeah. And for him, the jokes are perfect. They're he just understands his voice.
Yeah.
And when he gets into that, it just makes people laugh so fucking hard.
Yeah.
And I love that kind of comedy. And Kevin had, that's the one night I drank in my life. I did drink one night in the last 34 years, and that was Kevin Meaney's funeral.
Oh.
He was like one of my best friends in the world.
Really?
Yeah. We grew up one town away from each other in New York. And so my father, when he started to make some money, joined a golf club. And, and Kevin was a waiter at the golf club.
Yeah.
And he would entertain the diners. He would come out and this is where he got the bow tie from. And he used to come out and he would do the cheesecake, boats are coming.
Yeah.
And we talk about for dessert tonight, we got the New York cheesecake. Cheesecake boats are coming. And he'd sing a song in the dining room.
Yeah.
And so eventually my father said, you should do stand-up comedy. He goes, I'm friends with the owner of Catch. He goes, I could get you on stage. And so that was the first time Kevin did stand-up comedy.
Wow.
And so he used to come on my dad's radio show when he was coming up. And they were very close, my father and Kevin. And so, and I knew Kevin because I was a kid at the country club.
Right.
And so I was ordering, Kevin, give me another Coke.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he'd have to bring me Cokes. And so years later, my father goes, look up that. Remember Kevin, that funny waiter at Nolan? Yeah. He goes, well, he's really big at stand-up. Right? He had just done Letterman. He had just done an HBO special. And so I went to Catch a Rising Star in Boston. And I sat in the room.
Before you did comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sat with him. I was like just, I'd maybe done it a few times, like at college comedy nights or something. And I went and I saw him and I just, you know, like people talk about your ribs hurting, like literally a physical pain from watching this guy kill like
that. Yeah,
yeah. He crowd files out. I hang around. He comes over and he looks at me. And he hasn't seen me since I was 11 years old. And he goes, Fitzsimmons. And we started talking on the phone. He started bringing me at an open forum on the road years later, and we became, got to the point where he was in my wedding party, I was in his wedding party,
oh, wow.
And we were just as close as you could be. And so I gave the eulogy at his funeral, and then that night, I had a few long pulls from a bottle of Chivas.
How was that?
Really nice. I got warm all over, I got tingly, the pain went away.
Yeah, you knew why you did it.
But then that was it. Next day, I was like, all right, that happened. Move on.
Yeah, I smoked a cigarette with Keith Richards because I had to.
No. Yeah. No shit.
Well, I knew, like, I'm always on nicotine. So I knew I was on the lozenges. So I knew I didn't want to smoke.
Yeah.
But I was interviewing him. You know, we were using a studio in New York. Yeah. So I get in there and he's a little loopy. And it's like one of the big days of my life because I love the guy. And he's got Marlboros there, and I'm like, give me one. I just want to hold one, right? Because I used to smoke. I don't smoke anymore, and we're talking. And about midway through the fucking interview, he throws a lighter at my head. So I'm like, I got to smoke.
You got to do it.
It could have been heroin. Yeah, you know, I got off easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, if Snoop Dogg wanted to smoke a joint with me, I would probably smoke a joint. I had a period of like 4 years where I was taking edibles to go to sleep during the pandemic.
Oh, yeah?
And then about 6 months ago, I just went, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
And
why? Because you were taking them in the morning?
No, it never got past just that. And I took a small amount.
Yeah,
it was like a micro dose. Well, I stopped and I was worried. I did it to help sleep during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I stopped and I slept fine that night. And I was like, all right, that's bullshit.
Yeah.
All the things that weed is good for this. Weed's good. No, weed makes you anxious. It makes you lazy. And, you know, I'm not saying outlaw it, but stop fucking romanticizing it.
Oh, yeah. And now everyone is fucking high all the fucking time. Like, I know what it did to me. I smoked weed every day at some point. Eventually, you just get detached.
Yes.
And you don't know if you're high anymore.
Right.
And, like, I, you know, I just, yeah, I remember Kim and I, when I was married to her, went up to visit my dying aunt, and I was just saturated in weed.
Hmm.
And she's like on her way out, and she's like kind of no filter and you know, kind of beside herself in the bed. And I'm sitting there with Kim, and she goes to Kim, she goes, "What's the matter with Mark? He looks haunted." Haunted. Oh, I'm like, wow.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Because you get so in your head, and that's not great for me. So
Kim was a friend of mine at BU.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
That's
yeah.
probably how I knew you through her.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I loved her. She was great.
So the special, what's it called?
It's called You Know Me.
Yeah. I watched it and he shot it at Joe's Club.
Yep.
And it's interesting because you do, your style lends itself to a particular type of audience that likes that, you know, like you're going to take it right to the edge.
Uh-huh.
But you do it in a personal way so it doesn't seem mean-spirited and the jokes are good. But I thought what was interesting about some of the jokes is that they were all going good, but the ones that insinuated, you know, you kissing a man.
Yeah. Right?
Like any of the stuff where the punchline was you being gay, they were kind of like, no.
Yeah. Yeah, there's also a joke where I talk about guns.
Yeah.
And it's an anti-gun bit.
Yeah.
And let's just say we sweetened it a little bit in post.
Oh, yeah.
It fell real flat.
No kidding.
Yeah, there's only two jokes that I sweetened in post, and that was one of them.
And then there was the abortion joke that kind of trickled down. You're like, I don't know, that's going to make the special. But I thought the special was great. And, you know,
well, thanks, man. That means a lot to me.
You know, and I enjoy watching it. I got some laughs. And it's good talking to you.
Thanks.
There you go. You can watch Greg's special, You Know Me, starting tomorrow on his YouTube page. Hang out for a minute, folks. Hey, look, if you want to hear those early episodes with Greg, you can listen to them on your WTF Plus subscription. Greg was on episode 11, 17, 57, and then a full interview on episode 139. The one thing I know about you, and the thing that always gets me about you, is that I know you've got a big heart, and I know that when you laugh, you know, that you have the kind of laughter that I appreciate, which is like, you might as well, you should be crying.
Do you mean that it's just that? It's like there's a lot inside that I need to get out?
Yeah, yeah, I can feel, you know.
Love that. I'm putting that on the back of my next book. When he's laughing, he really should be crying.
Right. And you know, I grew up with that. And I think that it's just like, you know, there's a familiarity here that would breed resentment. It's outside of professional.
Yes.
You know, that like, you know, we're similar. We're kindred spirits. And you know, that brings its own issues.
Yes.
To get those episodes with Greg plus every other episode of WTF ad-free, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's some muddy guitar. I like this guitar. This was good. I like this one. We'll be right back. Boomer lives. Monkey and LaFonda get angels everywhere.